Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Japanese mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and we're gonna find some major figures in Japanese mythology, and some figures where it's hard to figure out why they were included while others were not. But never mind about that, let's jump right in. Our first deity is Hachiman, who is presented here as a war god, which is, I mean, that's about right. I think if I had to be nitpicky, I would say that Hachiman is more like a god of warriors. A patron deity of soldiers. Hachiman is a deified mortal. He was originally Emperor Ojin, although maybe Emperor Ojin was an earthly avatar of Hachiman, but my understanding is that he is associated with Emperor Ojin. Emperor Ojin is like a lot of the emperors in the kind of early part of the regnal lists, he is primarily a legendary figure about whom nothing can really be proven historically, you know, whether he was real or not, if he was real exactly when he reigned, etc. He's a traditional figure. Because Hachiman is a deified emperor, he has a role as one of the divine patrons or protectors of the imperial family, but he's probably better known in his role as a patron of warriors. And his role as a warlike character, and he is often portrayed as this kind of ferocious, intimidating presence, although not always at all, but that is something that arises from his cult rather than the other way around. So it is not because he is a warlike god that he became a patron of warriors, but because he was associated with warriors that he is presented as a warlike god. Because Ojin is an ancestor of certain samurai clans, in the kind of early to high Middle Ages, as the power and status of those clans began to develop, and specifically around their identity as deriving their status from their military prowess, those clans sort of adopted Hachiman as a patron, and they envisioned him therefore as embodying the kinds of virtues that they wanted to associate with their own social status as samurai. So Hachiman is sort of understood as being representative of courage and honor and martial skill. And because he was associated with those wealthy and powerful clans, they were also then able to fund temples and shrines devoted to him. This is something that's very important in a religion where, you know, there's no centralized, you know, there's not some Shinto pope somewhere who is saying, oh, we don't have any churches in this area, we'd better set some up. That's not how it works. So if your deity is popular among the kinds of people who can afford to create or support temples, then you're going to get a lot more temples to that deity. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean just societies like upper echelons, but absolutely that happens in the case of Hachiman. So the patronage of these samurai families leads to kind of an increase in temples and shrines devoted to Hachiman, and I believe he has the second highest, or one of the highest anyway, number of institutions devoted to him of any Shinto kami. Like a lot of Shinto deities, Hachiman also has a Buddhist form. He's sometimes identified as a bodhisattva, or even identified with, you know, the Buddha himself, and he is often depicted in the form of a Buddhist monk. And you might think, war god in the form of a Buddhist monk, that's a bit weird. But Hachiman is not exclusively a war god. He's a great object lesson in how, while there are some societies where, you know, you get gods who are like, oh, this one is the war god, in general, that is not true. There are a number of warlike deities, but Hachiman also has a number of other protective functions. Or not even protective functions. Like, he's also a god of fishermen. He's associated with divination and, you know, fortune telling. He's a protector of children. He just has a lot of different things with which he is associated. Probably the thing that Hachiman is best known for is the Mongol invasions of the 13th century, where specifically Hachiman is considered to be the god who was responsible for the kamikaze, the divine wind, the storms that prevented those invasion fleets from depositing a powerful Yuan Dynasty army in Japan. Do I mean the Yuan Dynasty? I think that's right. So Hachiman, as presented in Deities and Demigods, is very much his warlike self. This is very much the Hachiman who is a patron of warriors, and I think he's not a bad choice for the game. It's a little tricky, because I think when we look at a deity in Dungeons & Dragons, we're kind of approaching it from two perspectives. And one is from the perspective of powerful player characters encountering that deity on its home plane. And the other is in terms of player characters worshipping or being clerics or paladins of that deity. And I think the two things can often be quite different. So if you imagine a fighter who is devoted to Hachiman, this is going to occur really just through the medium of that character, that player's role-playing. You know, something scary happens and the character goes, "By Hachiman!" When faced with the foes that outnumber them, they go, "Oh, what would Hachiman do in this situation?" When they arrive in the town, the DM says, "What do you all do?" And the player says, "Oh, I'm going to pay a visit to the Shrine of Hachiman to make an offering, giving thanks for my safety." Just little stuff that allows you to throw in some fun roleplay, but doesn't really make a big difference. So there we can say, okay, Hachiman is in fact this very deity who has lots of different aspects and responsibilities, from patronage of the Imperial family to looking after fishermen. But the one that Dungeons & Dragons player characters are more likely to interact with is that one where he is a patron of warriors. A lot of warriors are going to focus their devotion on the warlike aspect of Hachiman. And not just nobles, not just samurai, because eventually you're going to see things like, I know, for example, that Japanese pirate fleets often have banners that have, you know, prayers to or images of Hachiman on them. I read a lot of books about pirates at one point, you know. All comes in useful sometime for a sufficiently specific value of useful. But then we have this other element, which is what happens when you encounter Hachiman on his home plane. Then ideally we would like to see him presented in a more complex way, right? To reduce him to the single aspect of the war god is understandable. And it makes perfect sense when we're down on the prime material plane and we're looking at a divine totality through the limited prism of mortal eyes. But on the divine plane from which he originates, we would hope that our sense of Hachiman would be more complex than that. I think that's the challenge when dealing with a game in which these deities are supernatural realities that the player characters are able to encounter. Which Thor are we talking about? The heroic giant fighter or the bumbling dumb giant fighter? Now, it may be that 99% of DMs don't worry about this stuff, but I do because that's the kind of person I am. Or worry about it a lot more than I worry about some things that are much more likely to come up in the game, like knowing how all the rules work. I have been hosting an Advanced Dungeons & Dragons podcast for over 3 years at this point, and I could not run a session of AD&D if my life depended on it. I mean, I'd do it, but I wouldn't do a good job. Okay, next on our list is Kishijoten. Now, this may seem very familiar. This is our third god of luck in two pages, right? We've had five deities at this point, and three of them have been luck gods. Six and three. Three luck gods plus Amatsumara, Hachiman, and Amaterasu. Fully 50% of the gods we've encountered have been members of the Shichifukujin, the Seven Gods of Fortune. Or have they? Kishijoten, more commonly called Kishoten, I'm probably mispronouncing that, it's got two S's in it. Her name means auspicious heavens, and she is one of the Seven Gods of Fortune some of the time. The Seven Gods of Fortune are a little bit like, they're not like the Beatles, they're like the Justice League. Maybe they're a little bit like the Beatles in but they have a changing lineup. Everyone agrees that there are seven gods of fortune, but precisely which gods are those seven, that's less obvious. So you will see sometimes representations of the seven gods of fortune, which include Kishoten, and then sometimes you will see representations that don't. Like Daikoku, we talked about last time, she is based on a Hindu deity, in this case the goddess Lakshmi, whose iconography entered Japan via Buddhism. So, in India, these Hindu concepts entered Buddhist teaching, then that got transferred from India to China, then from China to Japan. Another aspect of Kishoten, which comes from Hindu belief and Hindu art, I think in particular, is the jewel that she holds. In Deities and Demigods, this is kind of underplayed. Maybe we are supposed to assume that the magical properties of the jewel that she holds are bound up in her general luck distributing powers. Although I have to say that I am not wild about the way Kishoten's ability to kind of manipulate luck, given how much of this system is based on luck, is mechanically expressed, because basically it's just the DM decides. Yeah, I already knew that. But you can say that the luck goddess means everyone automatically makes their hit rolls and saving throws. I know I can say whatever I feel like. I would just like you to facilitate that, please. Jim Ward from the late 70s. But so anyway, yeah, she has this gem. In Hinduism and Buddhism, this is called the Kintamani or Chintamani. I'm not sure which one it is. Sometimes it's spelled with a K, sometimes it's spelled with a CH, but maybe it's a CH like in archaeology. But it bestows not only good fortune, but can actually produce anything that you wish for. And this is understood, I believe, if you're, you know, applying a spiritual understanding, this is a metaphor for the many riches and delights emerging from enlightenment, from Buddhist virtue and Buddhist teachings, rather than literally a magic rock that you can use to wish for food and clothes and stuff. But, you know, I think its folk understanding is more based on the wow factor of it, of actually having magical powers. It is called in Japanese, and I could not figure out how to pronounce this, so please forgive me if I get it wrong, a Nyoi Hoju, which means the As One Wishes Precious Jewel. And it's a little weird that its only specific mechanical effect in Dungeons & Dragons is that if someone gets too close to Kishoten, she can bop them on the head with it. And it does 2d10 damage, which is a lot of damage for a rock, but not that much damage for a jewel that can, you know, grant wishes. There's a whole wish mechanic in this game. Feels like an oversight. Finally, we have Okuninushi. I have talked about Okuninushi before, actually, because he is sometimes thought of as one of the inspirations for Daikokuten or Daikoku. He was once the ruler of all the earth. Ashihara no Nakatsukuni, the central land of reed plains, in D&D terms we would think of as the prime material plane. And he ruled over all of it until the heavenly deities, led by Amaterasu, asked that it be put under their control. I mean, I don't know if asked is the most used, but there was some difficulty in granting their request, but eventually he did. And in exchange, he retired to the invisible world, where he became ruler of that. He is a descendant of Susanoo, although exactly what kind of descendant varies based on your sources. The genealogies of the gods given in the different sources are not exactly the same. And he has a pretty good story. You know, he starts out as your young adventuring hero deity. He's the youngest of 80 brothers, and they all want to woo this princess. And he has a little adventure in which he finds and helps a hare, which the others have been given a hard time to. The hare is hurt, and they, like, give it fake information on how it should heal itself, so it gets hurt even worse. And then he gives it the real scoop on healing. And in gratitude, it tells him that he is going to win the heart of the princess. And that turns out to be the case. But then his brothers get jealous and they decide to kill him. And then they kill him. Now, normally that would end the story, but we're talking about gods here. So he comes back to life. The brothers go after him again and he escapes them and he winds up in the home of Susanoo. And he meets and falls in love with the storm god's daughter. Maybe he meets the daughter first and falls in love with her. And then Susanoo says, well, you've got to pass these trials if you want the hand of my daughter. And with the aid of the daughter's magic and some animal friends, Okuninushi manages to get through all of these trials. Then he tricks Susanoo. I think he ties his beard or his hair to, like, the uprights of the house. Then he steals Susanoo's weapons and runs off with the daughter. And when the storm god awakens and enraged, he accidentally pulls his own house down. So he gets away, gets back to where he was before, and uses the weapons that he took from Susanoo to defeat his brothers. Now, you may say, wait a minute, that is two princesses that he has wooed. And in fact, Okuninushi is going to have way more than just two princesses. He has all kind of wives and domestic disputes to go with that fact. And as a result, he has a lot of children. And in fact, he does not fight Amaterasu's heavenly gods when they come down to Earth to take over, but he has them compete in contests against his sons. And when they're able to do that, then he agrees to hand over Earth and head off into the spirit world. So he has lots of adventure. He has plenty of romances. He uses trickery and deception. You know, he starts out weak and he gets stronger through the acquisition of magical weapons. I'm getting real player character energy. off of this guy. Now, before we wrap up an episode of Patron Deities, we have to make some time for the Albert Addenda. These are, I think I called them something else last time, Appendix Albert. This is all the result of a discussion that I had long before this season started with listener Albert, who knows a lot more about Japanese mythology than I do. And we were talking about kind of a way to redo the Japanese mythos section. You know, Albert felt that a plain list of deities doesn't really convey what Japanese religion is all about. And more than that, that the selection of deities was kind of weird. Like, it's strange that three of the seven gods of fortune are in here. Like, you'd think it would either be one of them or all of them. And he proposed an alternative set. So we'll talk at the end of the season about the ones that Albert suggested that are not in here. But also, he thought that you could tell an interesting story by interpreting the, you know, the initial conflict between Amaterasu and Susanoo as a kind of propagandized account by the victorious Sun branch of the Pantheon. And, you know, if you're putting together Team Sun and Team Storm within the Pantheon, then certainly Hachiman fits neatly into the Sun side, right? As a deified emperor, he is part of the Amaterasu establishment, and he, you know, he fits a war god into that structure. Whereas you can actually interpret Okuninushi as kind of an opposite number to Hachiman. I don't know that Okuninushi is a war god, but he is kind of, he does have like warlike virtues. He's brave and he's strong and he gets in fights and he has adventures. He's much more individualistic. But Hachiman's appeal is bound up in collective identity, whereas Okuninushi is more of an individualist, right? His whole thing is initially that he's a scrappy underdog. He has 80 brothers who want to kill him for the crime of having a girl like him better than them, which is not very brotherly. And he's an underdog in his conflict against Susanoo as well, where Susanoo clearly expects Okuninushi to fail these challenges, and only the intervention of the princess saves him. Well, not just the princess, but also his animal friends. This guy's got a real protagonist sort of character. But so I like the idea of the establishment versus the rebel deities here. And the fact that Okuninushi is, you know, overcome, and that, you know, that the story, the myth, has him agreeing to go into the spirit world. But one could easily say, well, you know, perhaps that is merely a favorable interpretation put about by the establishment Sun cult. And in fact, he was forced to go and didn't want to. I think that that's not an unreasonable interpretation. So I think the Albert Addenda allows us to fit these two deities, particularly Okuninushi, who otherwise doesn't necessarily fit into active play very much. If he's sort of no longer on the board and he's gone off to the spirit world, it's a bit weird to have such... It's a bit weird for him to be prominent in the Pantheon, but if that fact is itself exceptional, then things get interesting. Okay, that's about all the Japanese mythology that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the Japanese mythos, and we are getting weirdly close to the end. This is a short section compared to some of the other ones. But nonetheless, we've got a good few more episodes to go, and we will have plenty to do when we do our review of the section as a whole. So please join me next time for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.